our model is there. It's savanna, which is a grassland with trees in it. We can't go back to 1491, but we can fill those functional groups. And I think of solar panels, you know, all those plants, the cool season, the warm season, the mid seasons, the flowers, and now let's bring in the trophic animals, the herbivores, which bring in the carnivores, which we are a part of that, and the dung piles feeding all those insects, which that now boosts all those nutrients like to the birds, to the mice, to the boom, boom, boom. Wow. That's our model for agriculture in the future.
Welcome to the 364th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. I first became aware of the potential for blending livestock with woodland habitat a few years ago. While visiting Peter Allen's Mastodon Valley Farm in the Driftless area of southwestern Wisconsin. On a muggy summer day, Peter showed me how he was using selective cutting and managed rotational grazing of livestock to create a mosaic of trees and open grasslands, in effect restoring what's been traditionally called the oak savanna habitat. Ecologists are particularly intrigued by the potential for silvopasturing to sustainably restore the oak savanna biome that once covered an estimated 50 million acres in a band stretching along the eastern edge of the Great Plains from Texas into southern Canada. At best, 30,000 acres of the habitat remains in the Midwest today, and much of it is in the Driftless region of southeastern Minnesota, southwestern Wisconsin, and northeastern Iowa. Most of that savanna remnant is on land too steep or otherwise marginal to grow row crops on consistently. This type of habitat, which is in effect the transition between prairie and woodland, and consists of anywhere from 10% to 50% canopy cover set up in a mixed pattern, requires the regular disturbances provided by such practices as grazing to remain viable. Otherwise, brushy species such as buckthorn take over. Since hiking the steep hills of Mastodon Valley, I've had the opportunity to visit several other farms that are working to revamp the savanna habitat via silvopasturing, which is basically a system of combining livestock and tree production. I'm impressed with how this type of biome can not only sequester massive amounts of carbon and be a home to a variety of wildlife, but also provides a cool place for livestock to remain productive during extreme heat spells. And since the savanna habitat often exists on land not suitable for corn and soybeans, it can also offer a way for beginning farmers to get access to acres that would normally be too pricey to rent or purchase. So, I was excited to recently run into Stephen Tomford, a restoration ecologist who over the years has worked with farmers like Peter Allen to blend food production with natural habitats such as savanna. Stephen works for Stantec, an international consulting firm that, among other things, works on ecological restoration. He also is involved with his family's 600-acre crop farm in southeastern Minnesota's Goodhue County. So Stephen provides an interesting perspective on the opportunities and challenges related to blending domesticated agriculture with wild habitat. He makes no bones about it. In his opinion, the savanna is one of the most productive biomes there is, ecologically and agriculturally. Stephen is a student of ecological history, and a conversation with him leaves one convinced that we have a lot to learn from not only how natural systems functioned for thousands of years before European settlement of the Midwest, but also how indigenous people purposely managed savannas to create a productive agroecological landscape. I recently caught up with Stephen at the Minnesota Valley Wildlife Refuge in Bloomington, Minnesota, just a stone's throw away from the Mall of America. As you'll hear, he's passionate about the possibilities available to combine regenerative livestock production with a natural landscape like the savanna. Stephen started our conversation by describing what this part of Minnesota may have looked like before European settlement and how Native Americans utilized the savanna system to produce food quite efficiently.
We're really near the confluence of the Mississippi River and the Minnesota River, and this historically would have been an amazing real estate to live in. The trade routes across North America. We have fossil. We have carbon dating of artifacts found just below this refuge here at 9,000 years old. You know, and I have found a lot of these artifacts myself: chips, flakes, hammer stones. So, what did this site look like? It's really hard to know. And I think what we have to do is I always like to go back before 1492. when the Columbian period and the colonies started at that time. So I looked at 1491, and most of our area, and really let's go back even further in time than that. Let's go back to the last big meteorite strike we had on the planet, and that was 65 million years ago. It took out the dinosaurs and the forest. And those were very primitive species in those days. I mean, maples were advanced in those days. Buttercups were advanced. A very few flowering plants were those species. A lot of ferns, a lot of pines, a lot of cycads, not very edible food. And one reason that we believe is scientifically the dinosaurs were so large is because the quality of the vegetation was so poor, they had to consume so doggone much to get energy out of it. That meteorite strike ended the domination of Earth by those large beasts and forest. And out of that ashes arose the grasses, the asters, the legumes, the oaks, the birches, the five needle pines, the two needle pines, and the mammals, and eventually humans. And it took about 20 million years after that major catastrophe. I'm thinking of climate change coming at us today, you know, 20 million years for life on Earth to restabilize and then reorganize and start advancing forward again. And what we see, trend after trend, life is always trying to organize its own nutrient cycles to the perfection of Goldilocks, you know. You know, this one's too big, this one's too small, this one's just perfect. Life starts to make the perfect climate and everything to live in. So about 35 million years ago, the whole Earth really becomes more of a savanna, grassland-like situation. At 1491, we had multiple people living in this area, Native Americans, indigenous cultures. It was oaks, aspen, hazel, hawthorns, the rose family, grasses, asters, legumes, elk, bison, beaver. It was a movable feast. And what's really interesting, what we see through this ecological trend, is the vegetation goes from being less edible to more edible. So it literally was feeding the whole entire ecosystem, the vegetation that was here. And then let's fast forward to where we're at sitting right now here today. After settlement occurred, the fur trade came through. And the fur trade was really dominant on getting rid of all the fur burrs, especially the beaver. But what we failed to think about is we had to feed that fur trade. And that came from killing every single elk, every single bison, every single deer. We wore buckskin, and they moved those fur posts, not because the furs ran out, because rodents were easy to, you know, they repopulate, because the food ran out. We killed every single large animal. So when the first surveyors for the U.S. government came through here, 1854, they're recording a landscape, and we call that the original vegetation. They're recording a landscape where the herbivores had been removed from for at least 100 years, if not 150. I was just reading the other day that they shut the fur post down at Grand Portage, Minnesota, way up in the northeast section, 1803. They shut it down. Nothing was left.
That early.
Wow. Isn't that amazing? Wow. And then this is, and not to slam the refuge, but this is the outcome of what we've got. When we got rid of all the animals, and we know the Sioux Uprising, they were starving to death. They had horses, they had guns, they were in the western Minnesotas, western Iowa. There was nothing to eat. There was nothing to eat. With guns and horses, they still could not proclaim enough food. And so we by destroying the animals, we literally forced these people onto the reservation. Mm-hmm. And when they went onto the reservation, they took their fire sticks with them, no more fire. And just to back up a little bit, they were managing the landscape for thousands of years, like 9,000 years people have been living here. They were managing it with fire. And the fire was used for one purpose, to produce more food. This traditional ecological knowledge, you know, more blueberries, more acorns, more bison. That's how they managed the landscape, was more food. They were starved to reservations. The fire went away. The settler farmers moved in, and interesting enough, maintain the savanna structure. But when we kicked those people off and their animals and made it a refuge, we got buckthorn, we got bare soils, all those beautiful plants went away. And so we call this a nature refuge, or wild, and there's no more wildlife in the refuge. And my dad was prominent in helping get this refuge established. So again, and I was on the vice president of the Friends Board of this refuge, nothing against the refuge system. It's our story that we tell. I think going back in time, Brian, this question that you started, it really helps us figure out that's the model. That's the model we need to get in. That was their agriculture. Oh, let's burn this, and boom, we'll create a lot more game, more grazing, more acorns, more wild rice, whatever. You see what I'm saying, right? I can walk you through this valley right now and show you whole 2-acre plots of really just junk flowers growing there that were brought here by the Native Americans. And it's like, oh, ginger. Oh, here's bloodroot. Oh, here's... And we can show you, they're just in patches, always along a spring-fed stream, always near encampments. Mm. And it took me probably just like 7 years ago, I'm like, oh my God, I'm standing in a Native American pharmaceutical shop.
Yeah. I find that really fascinating in that when we think of agriculture, particularly here in the Midwest, we think of cookie-cutter rows, very, you know, very squared-off sections and all that. It was a form of farming. It was a form of agriculture that the Native Americans were doing.
Yes. They were managing the whole landscape, not 1 acre here and 1 acre here. They were trying to... So I think there's a lot of lessons that we can learn from this type of farming, and that has really guided my restoration ecology from just going... Right now, we measure how the quality of the restoration by how many flowers. Mm-hmm. I want to see trails from bison or elk or domestic cattle. I want to see dung piles. I want to see this heterogeneity. And I think that we have that in our DNA, you know. And I look at you and I look at me, and I know that my people were hunter-gatherers. It's in my DNA. You know, maybe it's 100 generations ago or 1,000, but I'm still a part of that. And so that helps me see what the land could be.
Well, one of the things you said that really struck me was, as a grassland ecologist, by default, you've had to become a grazing ecologist.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you explain that? I think that's a really interesting connection that... That isn't always the given, where somebody who studies grassland ecology sees the grazing connection, maybe?
So when I first started doing restoration ecology in the mid-1990s, I was just all about flowers and trying to do better. And with the scientific training that both you and I got, I was always it was always an experiment. Each project was an experiment. And then one day I started thinking, wait a minute, weren't there bison here? You know, very superficial, just the buffalo, not considering the elk and the deer and the bear and the passenger pigeons, but just starting with the bison. By the time I went to Madison to work on a graduate degree in 2005, I started to really see this. And what I got trained in Madison wasn't more facts, but more frameworks for putting facts together. And I think that's a great graduate degree. These are all the facts that you have in your head. Now put them together. And I started thinking about grazing, and I came to the point, looking at that vegetation becoming more edible to feed more. Just think of that. Paleoecologically, thinking the species of plants are evolving to become more and more and more edible. At the same time, mammals are getting bigger and faster, and woolly mammoths, you know. Think of that. Is that an evolutionary mistake, or is there a reason for that? I got to see to the point where the grasses and the trees, the savanna trees and the grasslands, are completely obligate to the grazer as much as the grazing animal is obligate to the edible vegetation. And even this morning, I was sitting on the front porch in Simbrota, Minnesota with my dad, and he was telling me about those pastures. I used to walk through as a kid and collect butternuts in those pastures, and every fence was, I could pull my wagon right through and get those, but, you know, I'm listening to his stories from the early 50s. And he sees it too, that they were just hawthorn trees in every single pasture and shrikes, and he's starting to see it too. He's going back in time, seeing how alive those systems were, and the insects. Man, it was hard to sleep at night sometimes with the crickets chirping, and versus the farming that we do now. And so I really came out of that school saying, this is where I'm at today. I look at everybody, and these young people are doing restoration ecology. Look at, I planted this prairie, and it has 20 flowers and you know, 20 species of flowers. And I'm like, that's so good. Where are the bison trails? Where are the wallows? Where are the short areas that have been grazed right down to the ground? Where are the dung piles full of insects that are feeding the birds? That's restoration. And I really think that we're going to have to change our metrics on what a prairie really is. But it cannot be a restored prairie unless it's going through biomass harvest by grazing. And let me give you one example. This is a research project I did in Madison that was just phenomenal, and it has to be published. And Tim Allen, my advisor down there, who's also the advisor of Robin Kimmerer. Okay, so we put those together.
Braiding sweetgrass.
Yes, braiding sweetgrass. And this is the story we came upon. We southwest Iowa, northwest Iowa, southwest Minnesota, big giant aquatic ecosystem lakes, shallow lakes, Heron Lake, Minnesota. 8,000 acres, maximum depth 6 feet. Any shallow water ecosystem, large one, is the most functional ecosystem on the planet, whether it's marine, estuary, or fresh. Those lakes are in the lowest basin on the landscape, so they're always getting nutrients into it. So why didn't those things turn pea soup green before humans were ever here? And that's a question that has perplexed us for a long, long time. So my modeling, I showed how there was two species in those lakes, canvasback ducks and wild celery. Wild celery was the plant, and it grew thousands of acres. And in September, the canvasbacks are all in Canada nesting, and in September, that vegetation would float to the surface of the lake and blow off. And behind, it left 800 potatoes per square meter. Tiny little potatoes per square meter, totally edible, highly digestible, very nutritious on a hard marl surface that the plants have generated, the marl substrate. So marble floors, 800 potatoes per square acre, highly digested, and the canvasbacks migrate from Canada into these lakes. And for a period of 10 days, they feast. They put on 20% weight. We have all the data for this. And when they leave that lake after 10 days, because the energy return on investment goes to zero or negative, they export out of that lake 70,000 pounds of nitrogen. These are conservative estimates, and 10,000 pounds of phosphorus. Mm. When we shot the canvasback into functional extinction in about 1905, that lake was dead by 1920. We are still farming on horses in that area. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just like, so we took that one keystone species, the canvasback grazer herbivore. We took that out of the situation. The wild celery grew wonderful for about 4 or 5 years, and the whole ecosystem collapsed. And I turned around, I looked back to the prairie restoration, and like, oh my gosh, nutrient cycles, energy flows, and suddenly the dung pile that is feeding the insects and more nutrient cycles and more food webs, and oh my gosh, we can't restore anything unless we restore those nutrient cycles. We need herbivores on the land like crazy.
I love that example, because we are definitely dealing with an issue where the nutrient cycle is completely collapsed.
Completely out of whack.
I've been talking to a lot of farmers recently who are very interested in and kind of starting to get into and research doing silvopasturing. And one of the nice things about silvopasturing is it really fits nicely with restoring savanna ecosystems. And another thing, I'm going to quote you back again, is you have said that you feel like the savanna system is the highest form of productive sustainability. Why is that? What's going on there? That's pretty high praise there for this system that I think people don't even maybe before we even jump into that, maybe you should just give us a brief primer on what is a savanna habitat, you know, because people may not even recognize what that is.
And that's one thing I inspired Pete Allen with, and Pete and I inspired each other with, would be the best way to put that. If we look at the savanna, if we look at Earth in general, we went from being bacteria, photosynthetic bacteria, cyanobacteria, algae, ferns and dragonflies, the dinosaurs, to mammals, endothermic, live birth instead of eggs, like fish eggs, and then the sperm flows through the water to eggs that we sit on, to now it's live birth. You see what I'm saying? Life complexifies. You think of a Model A car, and what I drove up here today and what you drove up, your Toyota Tacoma, is a lot different from the and that's what life on Earth, it keeps reinventing itself and increasing that complexity and regulating. Like your car, the oil flow, the temperature gauge, the interior temperature, you know. So that's what Earth was doing. And the terrestrial ecosystem, if we look at the fossil record, or even if your creation, if we look at the creation side of that, we see that the species that came out of that last major extinction, and we're here in 1491, were the most advanced, the most productive, the most edible, the most nutrient cycling, promoting life, food webs like crazy, which also cycled the nutrients. Nitrogen was not in the ground. It was in an organism someplace. If it hit the ground, it was immediately back into an organism. Read Eldo Leopold's Odyssey, and he's got it in the 1930s. Mm. And as nitrogen gets into the river, it is taken out of the river by a muskrat who is eaten by an eagle who flies up to the tree, who drops it in the grass, and grasses of the nitrogen, eaten by a deer, eaten by a wolf who poops up on top of the hill. You see, and Leopold tells this beautiful story. He's like, oh my God, it's beautiful. So the savannas became the ultimate terrestrial ecosystem worldwide to regulate nitrogen and carbon. There's a soil scientist named Greg Retallack at University of Eugene. He's emeritus too right now. But in 2012 and I think 2013, he came out with two incredible papers that the glaciers and cool, dry Earth is the cause of what drove that glaciation and cool, dry Earth were grazing mammals and grassland ecosystems. just made that, you know, you think about a big hairy woolly mammoth or a big hairy human or my golden retriever dog, cool dry is the preferred, you know, and the oaks and everything, just, I mean, that's what they're looking for. And even kind of some of the sides I show sometimes, Arctic tundra, grasses, sedges, grazing caribou, oh, I guess that's in small trees, that's savanna. And one way the savanna does it, those trees create that shady area, so that maximizes the diversity between the shady areas and the sunny patches. That oak tree, here's a really interesting concept. That giant oak tree in that savanna, that pasture I was in yesterday down in southeast Minnesota, is pumping out 500 gallons of water out of the ground every single day on a hot summer day. And here's a cool concept. When that water molecule gets to the stomata in the leaf at the top of the canopy, and that this thing's shaped like an umbrella, so it maximizes surface area, right? Open growing tree like that is a maximizes this stuff. That's a good model for our solar panels, I think, in the future. But so that water molecule gets to the stomata, and now it has to change from water to gas. And that transition from water to gas takes out 440 calories of heat into the atmosphere. Standing underneath an open-growing big oak on a hot summer day, mm-hmm. air conditioning. Yeah. You know what I mean? Or a giant white pine or anything like that. So literally the savanna earth became the most highly productive, functional, I mean, and by function, I'm going to use an Odom, the Odom terms, Howard and Eugene, the original ecosystem ecologist, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant scientist. The amount of sunlight it could take in, solar panels and plants, and then transform into animals and water quality and soil health. And you know, that was the function of the ecosystem, to regulate or take that sunlight energy and make it into products. Mm-hmm. And those are the ecosystem services. They're the greatest amount of the greatest amount of food, everything comes out of these savannas. And we came out of the savannas, too. You know, we came out of the trees. And maybe, I mean, that's just one story. It's a scientific story. But that's our model for agriculture in the future. And like we were saying earlier, we can't go back to 1491. Mm-hmm. But we have all the functional groups, like domestic cattle instead of bison, will work just fine, you know. And we can mimic. So here's the one thing that we always say, when I say we, Peter Allen and I, you know, we'd say, you need to restore those important species, those keystone species like bison, or substitute them, cattle, or mimic them, hay. So we can work all that in. I can maximize diversity, not just of flowers. Flower diversity may decline if I'm grazing it, or it'll actually increase if I'm haying it. If I know I can increase flower diversity, native plant diversity by haying, the most diverse grasslands in the world are found in, you know, hay fields in Europe that have been haying for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to save those. They're so diverse, you know. So it's nitrogen. You draw down the nitrogen, diversity skyrockets, and edibility does too. So that's our model, that we can use the savanna. And there's, think of the permacultures in there that you've got with the nut trees and the berry trees and the grasses. And as you know, it's just like, as you guys know specifically, you know, LSP, the sun falls to the grass, no fossil fuels there. The cow comes along and eats the grass, no fossil fuels there. We milk the cow and turn it into cheese, another transformation, much higher quality product than the grass, and or beef or hide or leather or wool. Wow.
The whole savanna ecosystem, I think, is a really good reminder of people who, because this is something that I didn't think about, we really aren't the climax community, where it's the most mature forest or the most mature system, is not the most productive. That oak savanna system is a prime example of that. You don't want to be in that climax situation if you're going to get the most productivity.
Yes. Wow, good point, Brian. I'm glad you... And I was just talking to a person driving up here, and she wants to move up from New York and get into restoration. And I was talking about one of the blocks that we have, and I've been fighting against for 20 years, is the term forest. We really don't know what a forest there is. And I came out of Winona, and I was a forest freak. I love forest. But when I came out of the driftless area, I realized, wow, there's a lot of trees here, but this ain't forest. These are bare soils, and it's ugly in here. And it's like, what was? I didn't even know what a savanna or prairie was at this time. So the term forest or woods are really a late-stage successional seer. And that's like being 80 years old, you know. And so it's, I'm not saying it's bad. You need everything in there. But all of our plant communities that we target are these late-stage climax. Remember, we got rid of the animals 200 years before the first surveyors got here, and we just only recently made these plant communities. And so they look at the woods and they see all these trees with a few oaks in it, and they say, oh, that's oak forest. Oaks aren't forest trees, they're grassland trees. Mm-hmm. And we are killing the oaks by that management regime. And that's a common, classic example of what C.S. Holling, the guy who gave us resilience, said this happens all the time. We try to save a species, oaks, by restoring oak forest, we kill the oaks in the end. And so that middle, here's from a thermodynamic perspective. When you get old, you get leaky, your capacity to do work drops, and I'm talking an ecosystem here, but you can see the parallels to an organism like humans, you know. But when you're young and vigorous in those middle spheres, that's where all the work gets done. That's where all the ecosystem services, that's where all the carbon sequestration, that's where the primary nutrient, those are the most edible to plants, and holding it, this is what happens. In electric, okay? So think about this, all electrons. I see electrons flowing through these food webs, carrying the matter with them. Here comes nitrogen, here comes carbon, the electrons are going just like an electrical current. Of course, that's what you're alive. The mitochondria in your body are keeping you alive on that electrical current they set up, you know? So think about this. If I create resistance holding it, like on a dam, from going into just equilibrium, blah, you know, just like a puddle, curdled, right? I build capacity as a capacitor to do more work. That's what those middle successional spheres are. And ultimately, null hypothesis, you'd want about 10 to 15% late stage, old climax, 10 to 15% brand new, like 240,000 bison walked across this river yesterday. Oh my gosh, look at that. You know, this is like bare earth right now. Or a fire up in the Boundary Waters canoe areas. It is bare earth. And then you want everything else in between and shifting, constantly shifting back and forth. A lot of places never get to late stage. A lot of places just stay, you know, late climax. You know what I mean? So, and that allows us to look at our land and say, that would have been a climax woodland over there. That would have been all over there, savanna. That would have been a prairie opening over there. And so, right, that can help us think about it.
I really am fascinated by the savanna concept because it's a nice example of, I guess, working lands conservation, in that the ecological and the agricultural and kind of the domesticated and the wild can kind of all come together in one place, because so many farmers are saying, yeah, like you said, especially with climate change and increase in these incredibly hot days that we get, their livestock does better in this shaded system. It's also a way for them to build that soil health in a way that cleans up the water in the area, and they just talk about things like the animals being happier. But it's a real kind of meeting point for, I think, a lot of kind of natural systems and you know, kind of human based systems. You know, we have to produce food and all that. So that's what really fascinates me about that whole, and we're learning so much more about silvopasturing, which is combining trees and livestock grazing kind of thing. I think it's just a really interesting meeting point for a lot of these things.
The working lands concept, I started to push that about 07 type of situation. And I see that the combination of agriculture, I see restoration, agroecology, right? Mm-hmm. And I see us creating markets based on that for the farmers. I see programs in the future coming out that literally will, yes, we will pay you a CRP rental, but we want you to work it. We want you. We have 100 acres in CRP, and it's tragic that we cannot hay those sites to increase the flower diversity. We know by mining the nitrogen out of it. It's like, I can get you any flower you want if I can hay it or graze it. If I want more insects to feed more birds, I want cow pies in there, and I want cow trails in there so my turtles can lay eggs along the, you know, but we don't have that in the program. And it's really sad that the ecology, we know we need this and we would benefit these lands. But what we need to do is, the new policies coming out need to shift to allow farmers to hay these at some type of, you know, program. You know, I mean, just like you can hay at this period and this period and this period and graze it at these periods type of situation. And I've always thought, Brian, if we could help farmers capture 20% of their land or 10% of their land by haying or grazing, to really get high-quality communities. And, you know, the high-quality communities are going to grow on the gnarliest knolls that are sand and gravel anyway. He's like, no, we'll take that. And he goes, really, that's not even very good land up there. And that's the land that we want. We can get all the flowers. if we could help market those people that I'm doing restoration and the rest of the land they could graze it more for their production, because I'm, as a farmer, I want this to work. Financially, it's got to work, and technically, it's got to work, and ecologically, it has to work, so we can pass it on to generation, and the farmer on a Sunday afternoon, after they can take a break and go to the local lake and go swimming and fishing.
Quality of life.
Yeah, quality of life, just local and regional. And so that's where I see that the restoration, the agroecology, and the savanna matrix really, really comes together. Where we were at yesterday, this young farmer who was grazing, we walked down to the healthiest looking oak that he had was all by itself, massive giant canopy on it, 100% canopy. And it was down to the bare earth, because the cattle had been standing under the hot summer. And he only grazes that through that section 3 times a year. And his first question is like, I don't want to kill that oak. And I smiled in my heart. I'm like, oh God, it's so nice to hear a farmer say that, And he goes, am I doing it too much, too little? And we said, well, let's give you a framework. Sometimes you want to do it more, and sometimes you want to relax it. And the oak tree, because the populations would have cycled. There'd be millions of bison and a few bison. And we know that for sure. But then his oak's growing down closer to the stream that's feeding into a trout stream in this area. This little creek, as it became, down facing southwest, so good sun, the oaks were getting sicker and sicker as they got more dense in woods. And think of this. Everybody who sees, picture an open-grown oak right now in your mind, shaped like an umbrella all the way around. Those oaks started to lose 70% of their lungs or their solar panel, and their canopies were the only thing alive. They're super stressed. They're failing to funguses. They're surrounded by all these junky trees. There's no grass in there. The soils are eroding in the trout stream. We're like, bring this thing right down to the creek's edge. We can make sure that the grazing doesn't destroy the stream. This whole hill will quit eroding. You'll have more pasture. We'll have more birds and insects. The oaks will be healthier. The stream will be healthier. Why aren't we doing this? And not only that, but the people around this area, is pretty close to Rochester, are eating healthy food.
Yeah.
And maybe you need some more people to help you do the fencing and the haying. And, oh, my God, now we got jobs. And, oh, my, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I want to get back to those communities that are healthy. And we have so many people, as you know, younger people that are like that farmer I was with yesterday. He wants to do the right thing for the land, make a living. Not necessarily get, he's just, I want to make a living for my family. I want my kids to have something fun to do and compelling. And it's such an opportunity. We're right at that cusp. And I think one reason I really enjoy your organization is the policy part of your organization. We really need that forefront, that voice out there. And yeah, let's get together. Everybody get together, the farmers, and let's make the changes that we want to see in the land and in our communities. And what I love working with grazers too is that each grazer is very independent, what works best for them based on their job, based on their land. And when I was at Wisconsin, we went out and did massive grazing research. We went out with the Department of Rural Sociology. We went out and we sat down and we asked the farmers, 200 people show up to these things, researchers, everything. We'd ask the farmer one question, what can we do to help you expand grazing in Wisconsin? And we listened for 4 or 5 hours. And what I realized, there is no one way to graze. There's multiple ways. But if we can give them this savanna or this native ecosystem concept to go to, at least it's a model that they can make work on their farms. I just got up last Saturday. I was up in Spooner, Wisconsin at a farm. A guy has been grazing bison now for almost 25 years and doing savanna work. And you could see the next door where it was like a different property. It was so thick you couldn't even walk through it, And his side, I got turtles nesting, he said, I go deer hunting and I watch the turkeys walk, this guy grazes bison. And the turkeys and the bison came together at the same time, and guess who yielded? The bison. And he's enjoying his land so much. He said, I got bear out here, and somebody said, can I pick the raspberries out here? He said, you'll have to fight with the bears that come. It's just his whole pasture was alive. And this is what was really cool. I just get them started with patches of grass here and there, and then the bison keep pushing it back out and creating their perfect landscape. We drove into the pasture with the bison. He said, nobody talk. I'll turn off the tractor, an old John Deere Model 60 or something like that, and they'll come over. Sure enough, he turned off the tractor, and all of a sudden they came over and they looked at all of us, and then they went right back to their grazing. Here's a guy that did this on himself. And I was almost, tears in my eyes, like, wow, this is so, so cool.
The other thing that's kind of exciting is we've had two really, we're going through a period of innovation in two areas that are really fit in with this. One is soil health. We're learning so much more about what's going on with that soil biome beneath our feet and what we can do to improve it, and that we don't have to accept this resource that's been depleted. But the other thing is grazing, the rotational grazing, adaptive grazing, the portable fencing systems, the watering systems. We're learning techniques. I was just at a grazing school earlier this summer down in the Driftless area where folks were really sharing some really innovative ways of doing multi-species grazing. There's just a lot of innovation going on right now that fits nicely with all of this kind of restoration ecology and using livestock to kind of bring back some of these areas, both ecologically and economically.
Yep, and really good point. Here's the one thing that we can kind of like summarize is it doesn't have to be 100% native. Mm-hmm. Like those pastures I was in last week, it didn't even have to be bison. We could get it with Angus, we could get it with dairy cows, you know, easily, you know. Yeah. So this is just unique because it was a bison thing, you know. And I looked at the grasses and stuff like that. They weren't 100% native, but they weren't noxious. They were desirable vegetation, and we can't go back to pure natives. We can't. We bison and elk. So it was just this halfway thing, and I'm just like, he's talking about the turtles nesting in the trails, you know, and I'm like, oh my God. And so yeah, I think the innovation's there, and we, like I said, we don't have to go back. We're restoring the earth. It's regenerative agriculture. It's peak, literally.
It's not just sustainable because you're not just trying to sustain something. It's regenerative. You're trying to make it better.
We're building capacity by doing this. So it's time that we can start building policy and programs. But the most important factor is encouraging these people like you saw in the Driftless area and that guy up in Spooner I was with, and the kid I was with yesterday down in Olmsted County. And that's what we have to inspire. It's okay to do something different. It's okay to not want to spray chemicals on absolutely every single square inch. It's okay to do what you want to do instead of what the elevator tells you to do type of situation. And even those people in the elevator, I think, want to go back to what it was at one time. You know, it's just like, no, we're here to serve you, not to tell you what to do, you know, type of situation. Yeah. A lot of potential here. A systems approach. And like going back to our earlier discussion, our model is there. It's savanna, which is a grassland with trees in it. You pull the camera up high enough and you're going to capture trees. So let's just say the whole earth was some form of savanna modification. That's our model. We can't go back to 1491, but we can fill those functional groups. And I think of solar panels, you know, all those plants, the cool season, the warm season, the mid seasons, the flowers. And now let's bring in the trophic animals, the herbivores, which bring in the carnivores, which we are a part of that. And the dung piles feeding all those insects, which that now boosts all those nutrients like to the birds, to the mice, to the boom, boom, boom. Wow. And here's a really cool story for anyone thinking about grazing. I saw a DNR guy out in southwest Minnesota, right on the Minnesota-South Dakota border, how he got one over to grazing. He said, I do pheasant counts, which is a non-native bird, but I've killed a lot of pheasants in my life too. But he said, I was doing pheasant counts, and we drive up the road at sunrise, and we roll down every mile, and we listen. Do we hear any pheasants? And there's this one section of land that was privately owned in the refuge. And the guy grazed it. I couldn't hear a dang thing there because the other birds were so damn noisy. And I just drove by that year after year after year until one day I rolled down my window and I heard all those birds in the hall in that pasture singing. I was like, wait a minute. One pheasant cawing in silence or hundreds of birds sawing. I became pro-grazing sitting in that front seat of my car right there.
For more on how to blend agricultural production with natural habitats like the oak savanna, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 364 at landstewardshipproject.org. There, you'll see links to articles and podcasts related to silvopasturing. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. It helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendahl, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.